Clinton, the winner of a Florida primary that violated Democratic Party rules, is fighting to get that state's delegates counted at the convention. A day after campaigning in Florida, Clinton is back in Washington, D.C. The GOP's presumptive nominee, John McCain, is in California. The Internal Revenue Service says the United Church of Christ did not break any rules when it hosted Barack Obama at last year's convention in Hartford. Earlier this year, the IRS raised concerns that the church violated restrictions on political activity for tax-exempt groups when it let Obama give a speech. It later determined that the UCC took steps to avoid any appearance that the event was political. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from UPS, helping companies meet global commitments with time-definite delivery to major destinations. Learn more at ups.com/whiteboard.
Before you head out on vacation, join us on Friday, June 6th for our first annual summer celebration on AM 580. Get in the summer spirit and help us reach our June 30th fundraising goal with your pledge of support.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It is part of what makes a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. And Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the militarization of space. The Outer Space Treaty of 1967 expressly prohibited weapons of mass destruction in orbital space, and almost all of the world's nations have gone on record favoring the negotiation of a new treaty that would continue, though, to secure space as a weapons-free sanctuary. The United States, however, is not among them. We'll be talking in this hour about America's efforts to achieve military dominance of space, and our guest is Mike Moore. He is a research fellow at the Independent Institute. He is also former editor of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. He's a journalist, has been a reporter and editor for a number of publications, including the Chicago Daily News and the Chicago Tribune, as well as the editor for Quill, which is the magazine of the Society of Professional Journalists. He is the author of a recently published book that we will explore this morning. And certainly, if you want to read more on the issue, you can look for the book. The title is Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance, and it is published by the Independent Institute. In addition to his journalism work, he served on the Council on Foreign Relations Study Group U.S. Space Posture for the 21st Century, the Eisenhower Institute's Space Security Working Group on the Future of Space, and the Stanley Foundation Task Force Winning the Peace in the 21st Century. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. The number, as we talk here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line, and the call's on us. That is 800-222-9455. So here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, people who have questions are welcome to call. We just ask that people keep their questions as brief as possible so we can get in as many callers as possible. Mr. Moore, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us. This obviously is an issue that has interested you for some time, and certainly as indicated by your involvement in several of these kind of panels and working groups that are interested in talking about this issue and addressing the issue of space policy and the militarization of space. At what point and why did this become such an important thing for you?
What became important in the 1990s when we had something called U.S. Space Command and Air Force Space Command, who were developing doctrine for space dominance, space control and space dominance. They've used the terms interchangeably. And I thought, well, heck, the Cold War is over, isn't it? The arms race, the nuclear arms race is over. Why are we talking about space dominance? After all, the policy of space for peaceful purposes was established by President Eisenhower back in 1955, and it was later incorporated into the Outer Space Treaty in 1967. It seemed like a good policy. why are we courting a new arms race? So I began to take an interest in the topic. And when Don Rumsfeld was appointed as defense secretary, I took a very strong interest in it. I knew him a little bit in Chicago. We both lived there. And by 1998, I understood that he was in favor of weaponizing space. But I thought, well, he's a civilian now. That's not going to have any impact. But once he got into the Defense Department, he brought these ideas in an ever stronger way. Of course, he's not around anymore, but the momentum is still there.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly there are other people. There are other people in the defense establishment who think that having control of this part of space is vital to the security of the United States.
Well, yes. Actually, the military people, including Air Force people, are sharply divided on the issue, as are other defense-oriented people. There are people who argue that the Cold War was very dangerous, as it was, and the argument there is that we should never again permit any other country to challenge us in the way the Soviet Union did. And the answer to that is full-spectrum dominance on the land, air, sea, and in space. And this doctrine developed in the 1990s under President Clinton. And then there are other people, including Air Force people, who say, well, we should ratchet down this rhetoric about space dominance because it's going to scare everybody, and it may even initiate an arms race in space. So we have an internal debate here at very high levels about what to do. There are about 850 active satellites right now, and more than 400 of those are American satellites. And the argument is that if we initiate an arms race in space, if we provoke an arms race in space, we may have the most to lose if it ever comes to an open conflict. So it isn't a settled policy. Right now, the people I call space warriors are really in they have more power than they've had in the past, and then they have more influence, and we are drifting very much toward a space dominance policy, but another president might have a different idea about it.
Mm-hmm. I think from time to time, certainly on this program, it's something that we have tried to talk about, and occasionally, but not often, I think, does it get attention in the mainstream media. It seems that one of the things about this issue and the debate that you talk about is that it doesn't seem to have been a very public debate. It's something that maybe is going on in the Pentagon and goes on in the White House and goes on in the Congress, but it's not really an issue that gets a lot of open public discussion.
But I'd say the attention it's gotten is nearly zero. It's flying well under the radar. Mm-hmm. Very, very few people in this country even are concerned about it. Those few people are in Congress, in the military, and in aerospace industries, and so on. But otherwise, it's a hugely complicated issue. It's not a black or white issue by any means. I know many space warriors who favor space control and space dominance, and they're decent, honorable people. They simply have a different worldview than I have. In my view, the world faces tremendous problems in this century, from global warming right down to border crossing pathogens, and there has to be a lot of international cooperation in order to face these problems, to mitigate these problems. And I fear that if we initiate another arms race, we're not going to have that kind of global cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
And another point too, if an arms race does develop, and it is developing right now, the Chinese have been saying since 1999 that they want a new space treaty. And we have dismissed these concerns. We're the only country, besides Israel, that is not in favor of a new space treaty. And we use our veto power in Geneva to ensure that no talks take place. Meanwhile, China has been pushing for a new space treaty, and we've been very dismissive. And in January of 2007, they tested their own anti-satellite weapon. It smashed one of their own satellites, created a lot of debris in orbit. It roughly duplicated a test we conducted in 1985. And some people argue, well, see, the Chinese are really duplicitous. They're trying to talk peace while they're preparing for war in space and so on and so forth. But I think many people, including me, regard it as something different, that it was a shot across the bow. It said that if we continue to develop the capability to dominate space, they're going to challenge us. They want a treaty, and they want, and everybody else seems to want us to sit down at the negotiating table and talk about it, see if a treaty is possible. Our good neighbors, Canada, have been in favor of a treaty for many years, and they quietly push it. Our NATO partners push the idea of a space treaty, but we're adamant. We simply don't want to do it.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Mike Moore. He is a research fellow at the Independent Institute. He is a former editor of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist, and he is the author of the book Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. It's published by the Independent Institute. Now, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Perhaps we should talk a little bit about specifically what we're talking about here. There has, over time, I'm sure, been a lot of things said and written, some of them fanciful, about using space as a, in a sense, a weapons platform, that is, having weapons based in space that would be designed to attack the Earth, or perhaps weapons based in space that would be used to try to shoot down intercontinental ballistic missiles. Here, as my understanding here, the main concern now is in satellites and anti-satellite warfare. And the reason that's an issue is that obviously our societies now depend a great deal on satellites to predict, to gather weather information, communication satellites, and that's also very important for the military in their ability to view battlefields from space. So here the issue is, can one protect one's own assets, one's own satellites, and does one want to be in the position of shooting down somebody else's satellites to have that kind of crippling effect on their military capability and on their societies and on their economies? That seems to be the main focus of interest now.
You're exactly right. There's a lot of fantastical stuff in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s about beam weapons in space and lasers in space and unmanned bombers in space that could be called down on earthly targets and so on and so forth. And although that rhetoric still exists, it isn't anything more than rhetoric, because even the most ardent space warriors understand that that would be terribly provocative to have orbiting weapons in space. And besides, it would be horribly expensive. The main concentration now in the United States is on anti-satellite weapons, which could be launched from the ground, from the air, and from the sea, that could disable or destroy the satellites of other nations in a time of conflict. And we emphasize, in a time of conflict, we say that our intentions are perfectly benign, they're defensive in nature, and we would only do this if another country went to war with us. On the other hand, other nations have to, in fact, all nations have to assess capabilities of their possible rivals, and intentions can change, but capabilities are measurable. And the idea that another nation like China or Russia or just any nation would assume that our intentions would always be benign, that would be a little bit silly. Realists don't do that. They assume that intentions can change, and if we have the capability to destroy other nation satellites, then we might preemptively do it. In fact, our national space policy leaves a lot of room for preemptive measures on the part of the United States, and that scares a lot of people. It's widely believed that if you can control space, and anti-satellite weapons are necessary to control space, you can control the world. I happen to believe that isn't really possible, to be honest. But a lot of people believe it's true in other countries, and there are people in this country who believe it's true. And that's going to precipitate an arms race.
For some time now, the United States, and this goes in back, in fact, several administrations, has been investing significant amounts of money into trying to develop a system that would allow us to take down a ballistic missile, armed presumably with nuclear warheads, that someone would launch against the United States, take it down before it has the opportunity to come down and strike its target in the United States. Is there some connection between that effort to develop a system like that and the kind of thing that we're talking about here? I guess the question is, can an anti-missile defense system be also used as an anti-satellite weapon?
Well, the answer is absolutely, and everybody in the space business knows it perfectly well. They talk about it among themselves in closed-door meetings, and anti-ballistic missile system, when you develop an anti-ballistic missile system, you're developing the infrastructure needed for an anti-satellite system. We've put many billions of dollars over the years in developing an anti-ballistic missile system that most scientists believe would never work if a missile were actually fired at us. But the infrastructure is necessary for an anti-satellite system that would work very nicely. Satellites are much easier to hit than ballistic missiles. You don't know when a ballistic missile might be launched at you. You don't know where it would come from precisely. The system has to react within seconds, and has to hit an object traveling at 15,000 miles an hour in space. It's really a system that is not likely to work. On the other hand, if you want to damage or destroy a satellite, you know where that satellite's going to be at every second, because the satellites travel precise orbits. You can choose your time. You can shoot at it when it's in direct sunlight, so it's easily observable. It's very easy to hit a satellite for a country like the United States or Russia or in China, and other countries are not far behind.
We have a caller here, and I'd like to tell people who are listening that your questions are welcome. You want to join in the conversation, you can do that very easily by calling us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. That's the toll-free line, and if it would be long-distance call for you, you can use that number. We do have a caller here in Effingham, and we'll talk with them. Line number 4. Hello.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I find the subject matter very disturbing. I'm sorry to say I hadn't tuned in from the first minute, but the gist of the conversation seems to be about dominance and the use of the technology that will ensure the hegemony of the United States. And am I on?
Yes.
Oh, I heard a blip there. I'm sorry. There it goes again. But in any case, the history of humanity to date, of the violence and all the other things that occur as we speak, and your allusion to the 90s of the progress under Clinton toward world dominance, and under the capitalist paradigm, that's very dangerous. How do you address those things?
Well, I need to emphasize again that the military people who are talking about full-spectrum dominance in space or on the land, at sea, or in the air, are not intent on dominating the world. They're intent on having a country so militarily strong that it will never again face an existential competitor. A country like the Soviet Union, we could have destroyed not only ourselves but the whole world with our nuclear weapons. That was a very dangerous thing, and their argument is that if we're so overwhelmingly strong in every military area, no other country will ever try to challenge us, and we're going to have basically world peace. We're still going to have small wars, of course, but there's not going to be another world war. There's not going to be the threat of global annihilation and so on. I happen to believe they're wrong. I think that overwhelming military dominance is going to cause an arms race. It's going to cause a challenger to arise. But they're not intent on world domination. They're just they're trying to protect the country as they understand it, and they understand power.
Well, that seems to be the most corruptible of the subject, that once power is achieved, then the situation is only matter of time before it arises when it is used. Yeah. The same with under capitalism. I mean, the horrors of that system. Look at the World War One and Two, and all the other colonial wars that preceded that. And now to date, with the likes of George Bush and Dick Cheney, who constantly use the threats. And here we are in 2008, and nothing has changed. And that's what frightens.
Yeah, well, I'm not really disagreeing with you. I'm just saying the military people who are devising or implementing the doctrine of full spectrum dominance are not themselves intent on dominating the world. They're trying to protect the country. I was on these three different national task forces in 2002 to 2003. They were closed door meetings. And they were composed of military people, think tankers, academics, all off-the-record stuff. And in 2002, I can say safely that every military person in the room was aghast at our drift toward war in Iraq. They were all against it. One of the guys I knew best served as a staff member on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And during a coffee break, he said, "Mike, I have never seen our foreign policy so highly militarized as it is now, and that scares me, and it scares the rest of us." The military, and I learned this during my years as editor of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, most high-level military people don't want war. They don't like war. They don't want it. They don't want to provoke it, and they'll go to war. I mean, that's their job. They'll go to war if the national command authorities, meaning the president, vice president, and defense secretary, say they must. But they don't promote the idea of going to war.
We're almost at our midpoint here, and I have another caller that I wanted to get to, and I want to thank the last caller. It just, as you have outlined it, I think that those people within the military who would favor the idea of full-spectrum dominance to include our ability to defend our interests in space, they would say, I think with sincerity, they'd say, well, what we're interested in is defense, is protecting the country against attack. So what we believe is that we need to make sure that American interests in space are defensible and that we can do something if someone tries to knock out our satellites. For people who would argue that we need that, would they be, if we could have some kind of international treaty that would prevent the militarization of space and would protect everybody's interest, would that, for those people who are concerned about that being a gap in our defense, would that satisfy them? Would they say, well, a reliable, verifiable kind of agreement that everybody signed on to, that would be okay with us?
Well, you're right. The people who promote dominance of space want to protect our assets in space, and if they believed a treaty would do so, they would favor it. And I'm sure of that. They simply believe that no treaty is fully verifiable, and then they assume that there's always going to be cheating. And here, I think they're kind of reliving the old Cold War paradigm. The next great threat, according to hardline think tanks and military people, is China, and they say we've got to be so well prepared that China will not arise as a next great threat. We've got to forestall that by achieving full spectrum dominance preemptively. But China, I'm convinced, learned a lot from the collapse of the Soviet Union. It learned that if you take on the United States in an arms race, you're going to lose and you're going to go bankrupt. Moscow wanted to create a economic system, a global economic system, in contrast to the Western system. It wanted to create a political system, global system, in contrast to the Western system. The Chinese don't want to do that. They want to join our economic system. They want to make products for the Western world. They need the jobs that their production facilities provide because they have terrific unrest in China. And we need the Chinese to buy huge chunks of our national debt every year. The Chinese are buying roughly $200 billion worth of treasury notes every year, and that keeps our interest rates low. We're in bed together. Why on earth would the Chinese want to provoke an arms race when their future prosperity depends on being connected closely with the Western world.
We're at our midpoint here. Our guest is Mike Moore. He is a research fellow at the Independent Institute. He's a former editor of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist. He's been a reporter and editor for a number of newspapers, including Kansas City Star, Chicago Daily News, Chicago Tribune, Milwaukee Journal. He's also been editor for Quill, that's the magazine of the Society of Professional Journalists, and he is the author of the book Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. It is published by the Independent Institute. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have another caller here in Champaign County where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi. I think there was an early book that actually shows that the fantasy about space really almost started almost post-World War II, and it's Jack Mano's book, Arming the Heavens. I think it's no longer in print, but it sort of rings a bell that the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists might have actually printed part of a chapter about the military influence on the space shuttle program, but that may have been another journal. But anyway, that's a long time ago. Out of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament in England comes this group, space4peace.org, and it's one of the reliable places you can still get this Vision 2020 document, which the U.S. Space Command has taken down and rewritten to take out the blatant garishness of it and the blatant call for hegemony through space control out of it. I just wanted you to react to that. But also, what do people do? I mean, there's very little reporting about the conference out at Strathcom and the activism that's part of the people are related to the space number 4peace.org group, where they had a demonstration and conference out in Nebraska at Strathcom. Very little reporting of this, but this is where the grassroots activism is happening, and I'd like for you just to comment on that, what kind of prospects there are. I mean, obviously, the power is at the Hill, but if people don't know about it and aren't activated and are just sort of inclined to be passive about the whole circumstance, people are not going to put the pressure on the politicians that needs to happen. If you would...
I fear you're not going to like my comment because I think some of the activist rhetoric is self-defeating. It goes too far, and
that's right.
I need to emphasize again and again and again that the people who are really doing this planning are not out for global domination. And when activists claim they want to dominate the globe from space, it turns people off. I think it just gets too extreme.
It's in Vision 2020. You can just read it there. It's
a
published statement.
I have Vision 2020. I have every conceivable document. I have all the books that go back to the 80s and 70s and 60s and so on and so forth. And I know where you're coming from, but nevertheless, my reading of Vision 2020 is not nearly as extreme. I think it's a dangerous vision. Don't get me wrong, because I think the idea of full spectrum dominance is inherently dangerous because it's going to provoke an arms race. And if China really does challenge us, then India, which doesn't trust China, is going to get into it. And if India gets into it, Pakistan's going to get into it. And if the Pakistanis get into it, then Israel's going to get into it. And pretty soon you've got a really terrible, dangerous arms race going on. And when I say dangerous, I have to explain what I'm talking about. I've been going around the country speaking about this issue for some time, and then every once in a while I get a question like this. Well, so what if there's a conflict in space? We're just killing machines, aren't we? We're not killing people. Well, that's not quite true. The global economy must have these satellites in space. Our global economy depends on these satellites in space. And if we began destroying satellites in low Earth orbit and creating a lot of debris there, we're going to eventually lose the ability to replace satellites in space, and we're going to lose them. Satellites only last a few years before they run out of fuel, and they have to be replaced. So if we had a serious conflict in space, a shooting war, so to speak, we would gradually drift back to a 1950s-style economy. Well, we have 6.5 billion people in this on this world now. We had about 2 billion people in the 1950s. So if we if the global economy collapses, we're going to have mass starvation. We're going to have wars for resources. We're going to have a terrible situation. So we have to keep space peaceful. We have to do a treaty. That's the best way to protect all satellites, to have a fully verifiable treaty.
I'll accept it as a tactical alliance with you, but I really hope you're right. But I think even a benevolence dominance Pax Americanus is dangerous, and I agree that we need a treaty. But as far as I haven't heard anything in your response, what you're suggesting, I really think that you should put your lot in, even if you have a criticism of leftist a theory. But basically, we do need to stop this juggernaut.
Well, I mostly agree with you. The notion of full spectrum dominance is dangerous, and that it provokes other nations. Also, as I've mentioned, intentions change. We can say that we would use our full spectrum military dominance in a benign way, but the invasion of Iraq didn't look very benign to me. We had the power and we used it, and at least 100,000 Iraqi civilians have died, not from our hands necessarily, but from we have disrupted that country, and a lot of people have died unnecessarily. Power is a dangerous thing. We have to use it wisely, and I don't know of any country yet in the history of the world that has learned how to use such power wisely.
Well, I don't know why you seem to undercut your own argument that there is this malevolent force inside the Bush administration, and it's actually not just inside the Bush administration. It's in the policy elites. They think they're doing what's right for the world, but you keep characterizing that we're reacting to some threat. We're not.
No. We're saying there's a threat. When there is no threat, and then we're reacting to our perceived threat. We regard China as a threat. I don't regard China as a threat, but because so many people regard China as a threat, we are reacting to it. One of the top space warriors said at one point in a moment of candor, "We're racing with ourselves. We're imagining the worst case scenarios, then we're trying to beat that."
And I have another caller here. I appreciate the comments of the last, and let's go on to someone else. This is someone who is in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello. I had an experience a long time ago listening to a live news conference of President Reagan, who blurted out, I think, that we were going to develop Star Wars and then share it with the Russians. And I said, whoopee, but why not get them to help develop it? And then we can all sit back and find out how to program it so that anything that isn't scheduled, whoever controls the schedule, will be shot down by the rest of us. But that never showed up in any follow-up, so it must have been squelched. Do you remember that?
Oh, for sure. Ronald Reagan was not my favorite president by any means, but he was a sincere guy, and long before he became president, he thought the doctrine of nuclear deterrence, mutually assured destruction, or MAD, was an evil doctrine. It was immoral, and when he became president, he wanted to try to bring that to an end. He really wanted to get rid of nuclear weapons. I mean, he was a nuclear abolitionist, and I used to argue with some of my colleagues about that because they couldn't believe anything good about Ronald Reagan, but he really wanted to get rid of him, and he thought his Star Wars plan would do it, and he was willing to share technology with the Soviet Union. His own people, as you say, kind of squelched that, but at least he had good intentions, and Today in space, this is the road to the future. The United States is so far ahead of everybody else that many people think we can just stay that way. But I think the answer is to share our technology, especially our space tracking technology, so that we can have an international system that monitors all satellites from the time they're launched to the time they die. And that's a fine way to ensure that nobody will ever attack anybody else. Because if you can't maneuver satellites secretly in space, you're not going to have any real space weapons.
Well, again, I hope they get to the question of the caller. Other people who are listening are welcome to call. We have about 15 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. Again, just real quick, I want to introduce the guest, Mike Moore. He's a research fellow at the Independent Institute. He's a former editor of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist, and he's the author of the book Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. It is published by the Independent Institute. Questions, again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You talked about the fact that going back, if you go back far enough, back to the, say, 50s and 60s, that the United States took a leadership position in trying to argue for argue against the militarization of space, essentially, and that we had a treaty that goes back to the late 60s that expressly prohibited putting weapons of mass destruction in orbital space. And that now, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, most of the world says, well, we really ought to have a new treaty just to make sure that we maintain our commitment to the peaceful use of space and not have it be militarized. What sort of movement is there now for the negotiating of a new treaty that it would essentially reinforce what the 67 treaty says?
Well, there's no movement in terms of a mass movement. There is a small arms control world in this country, and for that matter, it's an international movement, arms control. And their arms control people are just all in favor of a new treaty, and every nation in the world, save the United States and Israel, votes every year in the U.N. General Assembly to ask the Conference on Disarmament to start work on a new treaty. So we're alone. We have veto power in Geneva, and we use it year after year. We say we do not want to talk about a new treaty, and we give a variety of reasons, ranging from there is no arms race in space, so why talk about it, to, well, we simply want to keep our options open.
Well, let's talk with some other people who are listening here. We'll go next to a local caller in Urbana, here where we are. This is line 2. Hello.
Hello. How much, if any, is a profit motive of KBR and Halliburton playing into this technological build-up, the incentive to build those programs?
I get that question a lot, and I don't have a good answer. Obviously, the aerospace industry has an interest in anything that will bring them big bucks, and certain space systems would. But the people who set policy are really motivated, I think, by ideology. It's kind of a triumphalist ideology that says we won the Cold War, and we won it because we were so militarily strong. And therefore, the best way to defend America in the future is to be overwhelmingly militarily strong. It's an ideology. It's a triumphalist ideology that sees dangers everywhere and says we've got to preemptively meet these dangers and so on. So I don't discount the profit motive, but we've got to look at worldviews here, paradigms, overarching paradigms, and people I call space warriors have their own paradigm, and I have a different paradigm. It's not clearly a black or white issue. I mean, there are many shades of gray, and if you get my book, you'll see that, because I try to lay out the background as objectively as I can. It's a complicated issue. That's why it hasn't been on the radar screen.
Would you give your opinion on this anti-ballistic missile system that we spent tens of billions of dollars on and deployed, and it doesn't work unless they have like a homing device in the enemy missile?
Well, my opinion is simply that it doesn't work as an anti-ballistic missile system. It will work fine as an anti-satellite system. And again, everybody on the inside in the space business knows that They talk about it all the time. We have an anti-satellite system in the guise of an anti-ballistic missile system.
As earlier caller pointed out, there have been a number of ideas, a lot of thought has been committed to paper, that is, putting on paper ideas about what this would be all about. And as you say, and as the callers understand, that we do have this system that has been put into place ostensibly to defend against a missile attack, which also can be used as an anti-satellite weapon. So, but besides that, has there been much money, significant amounts of money developed, put into developing, say, other kinds of anti-satellite weapons or anything else that you would put under the category of space weapons?
Well, it's difficult to put a dollar figure on it because certainly some programs are in the black budget. Mm. And some programs have NASA money, some have Defense Advanced Research Agency money, and some are Air Force Space Command. But a common figure is we're probably putting about $30 billion a year into it, which is small change compared to the Iraqi war. But it's still significant, and again, what happens in the future is going to depend partly on who becomes president.
Has this been, I certainly haven't seen any discussion of this issue, any of the candidates, maybe it has been, and I've just escaped my notice. Is this something that has been, that you have seen people talking about, candidates talking about?
Well, I think Obama once said something like he doesn't believe we ought to have weapons in space, and I think that's about as far as anything's gone, but the issue now is not so much weapons in space as it is anti-satellite weapons on the land, sea, or air. And that issue has not been addressed. Now, your listeners can go to several websites that can provide a lot of information. One is the Secure World Foundation. Plug that into Google, Secure World Foundation, and they have a lot of space-related stuff. The Center for Defense Information, has a lot of good space-related stuff. The Union of Concerned Scientists has a lot too, and of course, when you go to those sites, they'll lead you to other sites too. Now, if you want to look at the space warrior point of view, and I think everybody should, go to the George C. Marshall Institute site. They have a lot of material that favors space control and space dominance. You can go to Air Force Space Command and find material if you dig deep enough. Or you can just go to Google and start plugging in space control, space dominance, and follow some leads there.
All right. We have other callers here, and maybe about 7-8 minutes. Next, we have someone on a cell phone. This is line one. Hello.
Hello. I know there's not a lot of time. How exactly would you verify a treaty?
Well, one way to verify a treaty, and which would be surprisingly effective, is to have something called a global space situational tracking network comprised of all nations that would track the orbital path of all satellites from start to finish. And you can tell a lot about the purpose of a satellite by knowing its orbit. And in the movies, these space fighters zip around like they're fighter planes, but in fact, it's very difficult to change orbit. Once you're into a certain orbital plane, that's where you stay unless you put a lot of energy into moving to a different orbit. And by tracking all satellites, you can tell whether a satellite has threatening intentions, so to speak. Another way, of course, which would be complementary to that, is to have a ground-based system in which international inspectors would inspect every satellite that goes up. Not too many satellites are launched every year, so that's really, really possible. But it is possible to verify a treaty, but first countries have to be willing to do it. The United States is not willing to even discuss a treaty, and even the Russians and Chinese who say they want a treaty are kind of skeptical about permitting full verification.
Well, I completely understand that portion of it. I was just wondering about the actual specifics of how you would do it once you actually got them to agree to it. So now I kind of have an understanding of that. So, but yes, I do understand their reluctance to even agree to it. But thank you.
Yeah, and would it be possible to, for someone, if they wanted to build a ground-based anti-satellite system, would it be possible to build such a thing without the rest of the world catching on?
Not really. Unlike nuclear weapons, you can go a long ways in building a nuclear weapon without testing it. And biological and chemical weapons, that's quite unverifiable. But if you want to build a reliable anti-satellite system, at some point you've got to begin testing in space. And that, once you start doing that, it's visible, certainly to the United States. For instance, the Chinese ASAT test in January 2007 was the third time they'd tried it. And we knew the first time, we knew the second time, then we knew the third time. We can keep track of those things quite easily. And you simply cannot produce a comprehensive anti-satellite system without extensive testing.
Another caller here in Morris. This is line 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Hey, good morning. You know what? I kind of agree with you with the testing bit, but at the same time, you know, they're vulnerable to being shot down. So, I mean, here's the thing. How long would it take to do countermeasures? If somebody decided to take our satellites out, that could greatly diminish, in some respects, our ability to see if they knew exactly what they were shooting at. And secondly, it would take so long for our guys to shoot the incoming down that I think we'd have a problem. And I think that's the big key now. But I agree, though. We got enough bombs out there. I think it's overkill. Everybody knows what one atomic bomb can do. And I even think, the wackos in Iran are the same, know exactly what this, they're using, I think strictly deterrent. There's a lot of paranoia around these things, and I just think the world knows a lot more about these bombs than, in the previous years, and I think we're more apt not to use them. I'm just curious what you think. Thank you, and I'll hang up.
Well, I don't know quite what to say to that. It really isn't possible for another country, even an advanced country like Russia, to take out a significant number of American satellites without extensive testing, and we would certainly react to that. But that's why we need a treaty, to prevent extensive testing by anybody or any testing period. Even if all of our satellites were knocked out, that would create a huge problem for us, but we have other ways of conducting war without using satellites. It would go back to the less precise form of war, but we have unmanned aerial vehicles, for instance, and we have fighter planes with long range. I mean, we have many ways of retaliating if somebody really starts a war against our satellites. Some of the extreme space warriors talk about a space Pearl Harbor, and yet in these closed door meetings that I used to go to, where you had high-level people, everybody just poo-pooed the idea of a space Pearl Harbor. It just isn't going to happen. Hitting satellites is pretty easy for a highly developed country like ours, but it isn't easy for anybody else. The ultimate nightmare, though, is if a country develops nuclear weapons that they can put on Scud missiles and shoot them into space and explode them just in empty space, and you can destroy a lot of satellites by doing that.
So this notion that even if we had a treaty, had a verifiable treaty, that there might be some rogue interest somewhere that would still want to attack American satellites, and some people then would argue that we still need to have some kind of defense, then you would say that the idea of surprise attack is so unlikely as to be negligible, and that then if somebody was going to develop some sort of means to do that, that we would have enough. We would know in time enough to address that.
I'm saying exactly that, but a country like Iran, if it had nuclear weapons, and it has enough capability to fire nuclear weapons into space, if it had nuclear weapons, it could presumably detonate a few nuclear weapons in space. And that wouldn't be an attack on American satellites. That would be an attack on all satellites. Yeah. It would indiscriminately put all satellites out of commission. So the question is, would a country like Iran do it? Our own space weapons would not be a defense against that. The only defense you have against that kind of thing is to ensure that countries like Iran don't develop nuclear weapons.
One more caller here in Chicago. This is line four. Hello.
I remind you of the former director of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, Schwartz, I think you might have known of him. He pointed out that since the Second World War, this country spent over $10 to $15 trillion on armament and munitions up until the millennium. And then the point I'd like to make about this matter of prevention is a real course, and then we won't have to deal with the false things that like war anymore. Because the irony and folly of war can be illustrated by the fact that after the Second World War, Japan and Germany attained further development creatively, constructively, and peacefully through economic means rather than war, which is destructive. So all the excess of spending on armaments and munitions it's bankrupted all the countries that have certainly been involved in it, and we have to go to on the course of peaceful applications. Just think of all the beneficial results we could have obtained with all those resources for better relationships and in dealing and building each other. Well, I just thought I'd interject that point that the space program should be definitely used for peaceful purposes, but restricting the war aspect to even if you're on the ground is something we have to strive for more so. And we should certainly bankrupted ourselves as we see occurring right now with the Iraq war going on. Thank you.
Well, I agree with the caller perfectly, and the book he refers to is called Atomic Audit. It was published by Brookings. I don't know if it's still in print, but you could certainly go to the used book market on the web and find it. It's a fine book. It's very, very useful. And I recommend it to everyone.
All right. Well, we're going to have to finish because we've come to the end of the time. And certainly, if you're interested in reading more on this very subject and you're looking for more to think about, one book that you can look at is the one that's been authored by our guest. Again, the title of his book is Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance by our guest Mike Moore. He's a research fellow at the Independent Institute. He's also a former editor of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist. And Mr. Moore, I want to say to you, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you.
Our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part with funds from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information available on the web at infantparent.com. And that's it for us here on Focus 580, but we want you to stay tuned. There is much more coming up on the Afternoon Magazine, the usual mix of news and weather and sports and features and other things. And I believe the host for the program today is Jay Pierce.
You got that right, David. Thank you very much. Sitting in for Celeste Quinn. And we will have the usual assortment of news and information coming up in the noon hour. Then at 1 o'clock, an archived interview that Celeste did with Tricia Tunstall, a writer, teacher, and musician, and doctoral candidate in music education at Boston University about Tricia's book, Note by Note, A Celebration of the Piano Lesson. That's coming up in the 1 o'clock hour today. In Kansas City, July wheat trading at 8.06, down 24 right now. September wheat, 8.17, down 24. July wheat in Chicago at 7.53.5, down 24.5. September at 7.81, down 12. December at 7.91, down 23. July corn, 5.97. and a quarter, down 10. September at 6.10, down 9 and 3 quarters. December at 6.24, down 9 and a half. And March 09, corn at 6.38 and a quarter, down 8. July soybeans, 13.20, down 29. August at 13.21, down 31 and a half. September soybeans up 4 and a half at 13.57. And November at 13.21, down 34. July soybean meal, 3.26, down 6.50. July oil, 61.55, down 170. June live cattle, 9505, and that'll be up 42 and a half right now. The May feeder cattle at 107.90, currently up, make that down 15. August feeder cattle up 22 and a half at 114.60.